The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
The real star of the event was Viktor Orban, and in particular, what these parties admire is the fact is his crackdown on universities. So he's in control of universities. He's eliminated subjects that he doesn't like. His control of academia, which is the Hungarian Academy of Sciences is now, which used to have an independent status, is now under state control. And of course, his control of media.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 14th, 2020. Nobody has been more aggressive about using the coronavirus crisis to seize power than Hungarian strongman Viktor Orban. Orban declared a state of emergency and has been ruling by decree. He also instigated criminal penalties for spreading false information about the coronavirus, and his Fidesz party has effectively dissolved parliament. Joining me to discuss the decline of Hungarian democracy is András Papp, a Hungarian scholar of constitutional law and a professor at Central European University's Nationalist Studies program in Budapest, and Anne Applebaum, essayist, author, scholar of Eastern Europe, nationalism, and the former Soviet Union. We talked about whether Orbán's seizure of power is as big a deal as it initially appears. We talked about where Orbán stands in the pantheon of right-wing populists worldwide. And we talked about what, if anything, the European Union is likely to do about it. It's the Lawfare Podcast, April 14th. Viktor Orbán switches democracy off.
András, why don't we start, before we get to coronavirus or the political events in Hungary over the last few weeks, with a sense of the state of play in Hungary politically and democratically before, you know, in January 1, before any of the current craziness started. Where were we? How bad was the authoritarian rule situation in Hungary?
So Orban came into power in 2010, having received a two-thirds majority in parliament and beginning this long and very powerful march towards illiberalism. Then in the 2014 elections, he again received a two-thirds majority, which he lost in an interim election. I mean, he lost in a few months because his former minister of justice became a commissioner in the European Union. So there was an interim election. He only had a two-thirds majority with one vote, which he lost. So he did not have a two-thirds majority for the entire parliamentary cycle up to 2018. So I wrote a book on Hungary's, you know, democratic decline, and my conclusions then went, and that was published in 2018 or 17. So that was conclusions before his third successful election. And it was that, well, we have seen a complete rearrangement of the constitutional structure. All important institutions have been staffed with government loyalists. But so far, all the changes that we have seen and all this sort of democratic backlash pertain mostly to constitutional institutions. And it was all sort of on this abstract level of how, you know, the state is operates and governance and all. But it hasn't really led to infringements on fundamental rights, or for most it hasn't. There was the promise was there, the legal structure was there in addition to the political structure, but it hasn't been actually, you know. And this is something that has changed after the 2018 elections. And this is something that was a slow but very, I would say, rigorous march towards illiberalism 2.0 that was taking over the culture field, cultural institutions, staffed with government loyalists, changing the national curricula, micromanaging areas beyond the political or the, you know, the constitutional institution. So every theater director would now have been appointed would be a government's envoy there. Every, as I said, you know, school directors, and also there were institutional changes for the cultural field. So nationalizing, you know, public education sector. So it's all centralized and it's all under government control. So the government actually has control over, again, appointing school principals, higher educational institutions. Some have been privatized, some have been taken over. So we have seen infringements on academic freedom. We have, you know, slowly, you know, seen encroachment on areas that we have not seen before. And again, but these are slow changes, not very violent. Of course, the case of Central European University, a university ousted from, you know, so this was something that was new after in the second part of 2018 and 2019, and I mean we've seen things that were unprecedented before. So just a few weeks before the coronavirus came, there was the new field for government propaganda was, again, this classic slogan for populists was the European Court of Human Rights, so Strasbourg. So for the first time, the Hungarian government said that we are not going to enforce European Court of Human Rights judgments. One thing that was striking, and again, it's interesting now. So in February, there was a sort of a State of the Union kind of annual prime ministerial speech to the nation of how things are going. And for the first time, Orbán was speaking surrounded by military people, so soldiers, the arm, you know, this is, we haven't seen that. This is not something you would have seen since the political transition, that you would have a prime minister talk in, you know, surrounded by soldiers. And this is, and it's very interesting now looking back at it, now with having, the military taking over or having some kind of supervision over the operation of corporations and things like that.
Okay. So, Anne, the first time I ever heard of Viktor Orban and Fidesz, his political party, was back when you and I were at the Washington Post together, and you actually introduced me to their existence as an example of a kind of conservative reformist Eastern European party of the sort that, you know, was Americanizing and Western oriented. I mention this not to sort of hold your feet to the fire and hold you responsible for Viktor Orban, which God knows you are not, but to illustrate like how dramatically he has changed in his public orientation in the, I guess, 15, 20 years that he's been in a public role. How, like, again, prior to the most recent events, how do you understand democratic backsliding in Hungary relative to democratic backsliding in the other countries of Eastern Europe, including under the current Polish government in the country where you're talking to us from?
Sure. Well, first of all, you know, yes, you're absolutely right. Fidesz was founded very clearly as a liberal party. And in the Hungarian context, the idea was that it would be neither the sort of nationalist kind of rural, you know, thinking of the past, nor would it be the communists, you know, who are connected to Budapest and the cities. It would be something completely new. It would be liberal democracy. Many of its original leaders, including Orban himself, had studied in the West. Orban, ironically, on a scholarship from George Soros at Oxford.
That is ironic.
Yes. But he wasn't the only one. And their clear goal was to do a new kind of politics in a new situation. And I hate to tell you that, but Orban has actually been in public life for 30 years, not 20 years. He began as a very young man. He very famously spoke on a big state occasion in 1989 and, you know, called for the end of communism in a very dramatic way that many people remembered. And that was his first contribution to public life. Over the years, he made a series of decisions, first moving from a sort of liberal you know, liberal in the European sense, political party, then moving to the center right, trying to align himself with the Christian Democrats of Germany and with the center right parties in Europe. And now he has, in the last several years, as you've just heard, taken a further step to what, I mean, you can give it different names. I don't really like the word populism, but you can certainly use the word far right. You can use the word authoritarian right. You can use the word anti-pluralist. He's now a political leader who doesn't really acknowledge anymore the legitimacy of opponents and who seeks to maintain power by through a combination of gerrymandering, control of the press, control of business, control of the economy, and has become, he and people around him have also become personally wealthy along the way. So it's a kind of, it's both a creation of a one-party state and also an enrichment of the people who are connected to that state and to the party. And Fidesz is now a party that has a completely different status from any other party in Hungary. It has more money, more connections. It's able to function in a way that nobody else can. So you don't really have real democracy anymore in Hungary in the sense that you have some kind of even playing field and parties compete on it. And that's been true for some time. You know, one of the ways in which this happened, one of the reasons why it happened is because it was very slow. There wasn't a moment when, you know, he stood up, you know, there wasn't a Reichstag fire moment, at, you know, like in Nazi Germany, where he stood up and said, right, I'm in charge now. He was always very careful. He sometimes went up to the edge of the Constitution without crossing it. Sometimes he would backtrack, you know, he would pass things that were unpopular and then he would move backwards. So he wasn't, he was very careful to change things in what appeared to be a sort of semi-legal way, and thereby to, and also by the way, thereby to maintain his membership of various European clubs, you know, to keep his party inside the Christian Democratic Club in Europe, which is called the European People's Party, and so on, and this has all been a, it's been a very deliberate and not actually all that subtle attempt, both as I said, to keep himself in power, and to make sure that people around him got rich. I mean, it's very, it's important to understand that Fidesz is not just, it's not just about power. It's also about money. This is a, you know, it's a very profoundly corrupt party. The Hungarian economy has now been kind of twisted and molded to ensure that the right people make money. And in that sense, of course, it resembles Putin's Russia. I mean, it's a, it's, it, I wouldn't say it's like Putin in other ways, but in some, in this sense, it is.
You're in Poland now. You're, among other things, a prominent intellectual in the Polish context, and you're both associated with opposition political parties there and also married to a prominent former defense and foreign minister and opposition political figure. How does democratic decline in Hungary compare to democratic decline in Poland?
So it's a little bit different here. Before I say that, I will talk about Hungary and Poland, but much of what we see in these two countries, the changes inside these ruling parties, we can also see in other political parties in Europe, not necessarily just Eastern European. And so I hesitate to call this problem of democratic decline East European. The kinds of, you know, Fidesz is a, Orban's party is hugely admired on the right in France. It's enormously admired on the right in Italy. You know, the tendencies that you can see in these parties are there not because of some communist legacy or you know, they're there because in these particular politicians are, you know, are in power, but there are others who are not in power who would like very much to do the same. So that's just to say that as a really important point. This is not an Eastern European problem; it's a democratic problem.
Fair enough.
And it afflicts a lot of democracy, including the American ones, which maybe we, if you want, we can get to. Poland is a little bit of a different situation because the current Polish ruling party doesn't control as much of the state as the Hungarian ruling party does. And they've also attempted to take control much more quickly, which meant that they did it much more obviously illegally. So one of the first things they tried to do was illegally pack the courts. They first packed the constitutional court, then they've been trying to pack the rest of the court system. They've had a huge amount of pushback from the European court system, which the Polish court system is legally part of. You know, European law has to be applied the same way in European countries. So there is actually there are connections between European court systems in a way that Americans probably find hard to understand, but they're real. They're not just, it's not just a question of, you know, people in foreign courts criticizing Polish courts. I mean, these are actually connected court systems, and they have to, you know, they have to, and they share all kinds of, you know, cases, and they have to treat things in similar ways. And we now actually, I mean, before the virus crisis began, we were already in a judicial crisis in Poland because many of the changes that the government has made are you know, simply illegal and unconstitutional. And we were coming to a real, you know, kind of turning point where the decisions of Polish courts were about to be refused by European courts. And now everything is, of course, distracted and changed. But they've tried to take over the court system. They've taken over public media in a very ugly way. So the Polish equivalent of the BBC is now a kind of party political broadcast. It's unrecognizable as anything resembling free television. It's very, very skewed. You know, opposition politicians don't appear on it. They don't even pretend, you know, to be even-handed. And that matters because there's a big chunk of the country, you know, somewhere between 20 and 40%, depending on how you count, which mostly gets this media, because this is it's non-cable, you know, it's the TV that everybody gets in their houses, and it's on the radio and so on. And by the way, that was also unconstitutional, which is public media, like here, like everywhere, is supposed to be nonpartisan. So they've attempted to, you know, to make these undemocratic changes, but they haven't yet destroyed or eliminated the opposition quite to the extent that Orban has in Hungary. And there's still quite a, you know, here in the part of the country that I'm in Northwest Poland, all the local mayors, all the regional leaders are all opposition. Actually, mayors and city leaders almost all over everywhere in the country, and including small cities, it's not just big cities, are almost all opposition. So there is still the opposition has an important voice. It's just that because of, you know, legal and press controls, it's, again, not the playing field here is not even. But, you know, I can't stress enough. I mean, I was at a conference in Rome in February, which was described as a conference of national conservatives. And it was actually organized by Americans and Israelis. And there were representatives from all over Europe, from the French far right, from Marianne Maréchal, who's Marine Le Pen's niece. This is the niece of the far right leader of France, who is herself an important younger leader. There were people from Vox, which is the far right party in Spain. There were people from cluster of Italian far right parties. And there were a couple of polls, but the real star of the event was Viktor Orban. And in particular, what these parties admire is his crackdown on universities. So he's in control of universities. He's eliminated subjects that he doesn't like. His control of academia, which is the Hungarian Academy of Sciences is now, which used to have an independent status, is now under state control. And of course, his control of media. And Orban himself, while speaking at this event, was asked by a kind of sycophantic interviewer, you know, some question like, well, how is it that you are able to stay in power for so long? And he said, well, you know, if you don't have any opposition in the press, then it's much easier. And, you know, I laughed, and some people around me in the back of the room where the other journalists were sitting also laughed, but he was dead serious. And everybody else was listening very seriously. Ah, yes, if you could just get rid of this problem of the media, then you could have control for much longer. So it's a little country. It doesn't have much influence. It's very small. It's not very important economically. But he has, by becoming a kind of cutting edge authoritarian from, you know, within the European Union, he has set himself up as a model and is much admired by other Europeans as well as people on the right of the Republican Party in the United States.
Yeah. And I just to foot stomp that latter point, I mean, the conference that you're referring to was, I believe, organized by, you said, by Americans and Israelis. I think it wasn't it organized by, you know, a Virginia state senator or something?
No, it was organized by someone called Chris DeMuth, who's the former head of the American Enterprise Institute.
I see. So, you know, and a prominent American.
But he was a very prominent American Republican who was for many years, I would say, central to free trade, kind of anti-regulation, classic American Republican Party thinking and who has now finds himself aligned with the European far right.
Okay, so Andras, this all is the state of play before the coronavirus. And Anne said there's no Reichstag fire moment in Orbán's rise to power. But you could make the case that the coronavirus is his Reichstag moment, right? And just as Hitler, I don't want to compare them because Orbán is not yet anyway murderous, but just as the Nazis used the Reichstag fire as a pretext to get the Enabling Act passed, which was the basis for their dictatorship, Orbán has used this to pass some pretty dramatic laws. And so can you just walk us through how the Hungarian political system has responded to the coronavirus and to what extent it has really dismantled the residual fabric of democratic government in the country as a result of it?
Sure. If I could just return for two amendments to the previous issue, which I think are important to understand what's going on. Two things that I forgot or I didn't have time to say what happened before. So sure. One was local elections last fall, so 2019, which came as a great surprise. And essentially, Fidesz lost Budapest. So this is the line of big cities and also a number of other major urban settlements, so big cities. A number of big cities for the first time were lost, and opposition. And by the way, the opposition for the first time have ran candidates that were coalition that were supported by a coalition of the opposition party. So that was a novelty. This has not yet happened so far. So the fact that Orbán was successful was in fact due to the fact that he also successfully have abolished a potent opposition. And this was a sign, you know, contraindicating this. The other thing, not that important, but there was a lot has been talked about how Orbán's, you know, last step, and this is something that's been usually used as a parallel with Poland, the judicial system. So Orbán was to establish a unified administrative court, which of course is in charge of a bunch of politically sensitive issues, elections, etc. And he was supposed to create a parallel structure to the Supreme Court and with this sort of administrative high court. For some reason, he abandoned that idea. There was even a constitutional amendment to that, and a law was passed. And at the last minute, for some reason, I wouldn't say it's because international protests or academic or, you know, protests about that. But for some reason, he has decided to withdraw from that. So this is still before what's happening. And if I can just have two minor things about the general state of Orbán's state. One is that I would add is that sort of the semi-legal nature of this whole thing. I think it's very important. So I think cynicism is the most important, the core concept when it comes to Hungary. And I think this is a great difference when it comes to Poland. I'm pretty convinced, and this is what the literature supports, that Orbán does not have an ideology. It's not, you know, it is, even though he talks about Christian democracy and all that, it is about money. It is about corruption. And cynicism is also accompanied with an extreme, I would say, a fairly nuanced legal sort of operation. So what we have seen is what Kim Lynn Shapley coined as a Frankenstate. So when it comes to political debates with sort of this sort of multi-level, you know, constitutionalism institutions like the EU, the Council of Europe, all that. So you would have a legal argument saying that, well, but, you know, the structures we're introducing is not unknown. I mean, you see that particular provision in the German model. You know, Article 26 is exactly the same what you see in France. I mean, these are exemplary democracies. How can you say that this is not true? Stop treating us, you know, with double standards, right? So this is very much part of the logic. And the other thing, I think we have talked about the EU, the European Union not only allowed this to exist, but also funded this. So, you know, this is what's usually called authoritarian capitalism. And things. It's, you know, Hungarian economy and also Orbán's family and political family who have been, you know, becoming, incredibly rich. I mean, we're really talking, you know, oligarchical, you know, assets here, have been coming from either EU cohesion funds and, you know, directly from the European Union, all multinational companies or, you know, German big car industry, you know, industrial projects. So these are actually the engines that are running Orbán's regime. Okay, but so coming back to your question. So basically what has really been exploding in international media is this the law on the enabling law, the Ermächtigungs law, which introduced a special legal order, emergency powers. And there are a couple of things in it which are unusual. One thing that is unprecedented, and this is something that was really, you know, making people go berserk, is the lack of limits on emergency powers for the government to rule by decrees, even if parliament is in session.
Wait, before we go to the aspects of it that are upsetting people, let's just describe it a minute. The international press, the U.S. press anyway, has described it as allowing Orbán to rule by decree in the absence of parliament essentially disbanding itself for the duration of a state of emergency that has no time limit on it, with pretty draconian jail sentences associated with spreading whatever the government regards as false information about the virus. Is that broadly accurate?
Yes and no. So I think the measures that have been introduced are in line with what every other state have done in the region. In fact, they were somewhat even slower. So there was, you know, so we don't have a full lockdown. You know, some measures have been introduced of when people can, you know, go grocery shopping, and people above 65 have a reserved time range and stuff like that. So none of those measures are out of line at all. So basically, we first had a couple of laws and decrees, you know, introducing certain restrictions on movement, etc. The big thing was that something that really made international headlines was this enabling law. Now, it basically had, you know, most of it, I think, is fully in line with every country that's doing in cases of emergencies. What's relevant is again these two aspects that you've mentioned. One is the lack of a timeline and time frame. So usually, you know, what these laws do, they would say, okay, it's for 1 month or 3 months, and then Parliament has to extend it, right? So this is something that, and I can tell you why I think the government did this, why Orbán did this. So this is missing. The other one that is I think there is a reason why this is upsetting us is this. There is a new criminal sanction has been introduced with basically spreading false news that can be alarming or that can obstruct the emergency operations, and yes, that actually poses 5 or even up to 8 years of imprisonment. And the fears are that this could have a chilling effect on media freedom of press, basically. So anyone can be accused, and then if it takes a while until even you can be sent to jail. But even if you're not sent to jail, it can take a year and a half until a criminal procedure goes through. And by then, of course, the news organ will be shut down for that time. So that was one thing. The other thing that basically is somewhat, well, I would say relevant from a constitutional point of view, is that there's this sort of tug of war between the local governments and the government. And of course, in these times, the government is taking control over and have basically grabbed a number of competences that belong to local governments. And again, this is where it becomes important that the local elections a couple of months before have actually put opposition people in political power. So part of this whole regime is revenge. So now, if I can just have one sort of overall assessment of this, I don't think this is a big deal.
You don't think what is a big deal?
The whole package, the whole legislative package is a big deal, unfortunately. So, I think it's tempting to say that this is a constitutional moment. This is what Orbán has always wanted. Orbán came into power in 2010. He was, and actually he had introduced in some sort of emergency measures reflecting on a financial crisis. And they have been sort of nationalized. They have nationalized, for example, the private pension funds and stuff like that. He has been, he did not have, this is why I had this introduction, he did not have a two-thirds majority at the time in 2015 when the big international refugee crisis was happening, and there were these sort of dramatic events on Hungarian streets with refugees, marching through the country and heading to Western Europe. So Orbán did not have the constitutional authorization for that. When he regained the two-thirds majority in 2018, he did have a constitutional amendment, which, and I think it's very important, which ever since then, Hungarian parliament has voted and extended emergency measures due to extraordinary illegal immigration pressure at the borders, which is not true, which is simply did not happen because Orban built a wall. We had extremely strong criminal and other measures against illegal immigration. So Orban has successfully stopped practically all illegal immigration through the borders. So basically, the fact that we've had emergency measures, that has been part of the Hungarian sort of political scene for a while. Hungarian parliament have been extending these emergency measures, giving the government, you know, basically emergency powers, you know, for the past years without an actual emergency situation. So what I'm saying about this, that actually this does not give Orban anything that or much that he had not already had. So parliament is not dissolved. The government can do a bunch of things without parliament, but parliament hasn't been a player at all ever since. It's been the opposition has been, almost all powers of the parliamentary opposition has been cut. All the other, you know, political institutions like the Constitutional Court, all these checks and balances institutions have been castrated. They have been packed with government loyalists. So I actually, even though it's very sort of plausible that to say that now finally we have this populist, you know, autocrat who is this extremely, you know, who's always wanted emergency powers, and now with this constitutional moment he can finally grab all the power and build.
You think he already had them?
Everything. I mean, if you look at, you know, basically this regime was without any sort of control. Technically, not necessarily. And again, this is why it's important to say that this is a legal, you know, there's this sort of the appearance of a semi-legal, you know, legally constitutional regime that's very important here. So
just to clarify what you're saying that this is not all that big a deal because it is merely codifying formally and publicly what was already de facto true of the Hungarian political system. Is that right?
Yeah, so this kind of show, I mean, this is, if you know, it comes up as something shocking if you look at this. Again, the limitless government authorization is, you know, and I think I would think that Orban has done this intentionally in order to be, he likes to be in headlines. This is all, he has done this because of, you know, to provoke, you know, international analysts and the media and whatever the opposition. I think this is the other thing he has done, and I'm saying that this is all just sort of, you know, petite local politics. Again, how you can screw local governments. One of the first things he has done was, for example, to declare free parking, right? Which is basically a huge source of income for local governments. This is, you know, this is revenge on Budapest.
This is the equivalent of Budapest. This is the Hungarian equivalent of Bridgegate in New Jersey.
Yeah. and you know, also, for example, so one of the, you know, also this whole package, I think it was brilliantly staged from the PR perspective. Basically, he put through this measure. So there was this bill for this emergency law, and he requested the opposition to have this go through a fast track reading in parliament, which would have meant like 3 or 4 days, you know, 5 days. Of course, the opposition said, we're not going to do this because this is, you know, anti-democratic and whatever. This is, you know, this is giving you unlimited power. And then from there on, he could use this rhetoric, and this rhetoric can be used forever, that the opposition was against the Hungarian people, the opposition was supporting the spread of the virus. The opposition was obstructing an efficient way to step up against the epidemic. Now, this is brilliant. This is all PR. This is all the sort of, you know, something that's only relevant in this very local political power game. But again, my you know, most important argument, and I think, you know, lots of my colleagues may be, you know, disagreeing with this, but I don't think this is just, you know, it shows that the emperor has not been wearing clothes, you know, for a long time.
So I want to bring Anne in on this because I, you know, this frankly is going in a direction that I was not expecting. My assumption was that this was a watershed moment of completing the building of a dictatorship and the evolution or the change of this from a kind of slow motion degradation of institutions into a, formal declaration of a dictatorship. You're describing it as largely an optics matter because, in fact, the dictatorship already existed. And what do you think? Is this less a big deal than people are making of it?
I mean, I don't disagree with the analysis that, you know, the parliament wasn't really functioning anyway and the constitutional court wasn't functioning anyway. And, you know, this doesn't make that much difference to people's daily lives. I think that's probably true. I do think, though, that formally giving himself the power to rule by decree and formally giving himself the power to ignore existing law might not feel in Budapest like much has changed. But I think if you take a step back and look at it on a broader scale, you know, look at Viktor Orban from over the last 30 years, you know, from 1989 to the present, I do think it's going to be a marker that people will remember. Even if, as I'm sure he will, you know, after this is all over, when it's all over, he goes back and then magnanimously declares that now he's restoring democracy again. The point is, what he's just done is he's shown people how easy it is. With the snap of his fingers, he can say, I get to decide everything all by myself, essentially, and nobody has any controls. And in a way, a lot of that, although it was true before, it was masked by various things. You know, there was a parliament, there were judges, there were courts, and so on. And there was a sort of, you know, there was the kind of structure of democracy existed, you know, in Hungary. And he's now just really told people, you know, that's all rubbish. You know, it doesn't really exist. And when I want to, I can take this power. And I think that does matter. And again, I'm sure that if you're in Budapest, it doesn't feel like it because, you know, what's the difference between what he can do today and what he could do last week? But I think it'll be remembered as a kind of turning point. And I would also note that it is a power that he's given himself that nobody else in Europe has taken. And there are, you know, really serious restrictions on freedom of movement in many European countries right now. And there are, you know, police controls of a kind nobody could have imagined, you know, in London and Paris and so on. But there is no other European leader, you know, who has said, I now have the right to rule by decree and nobody can stop me.
Is there any other European leader who has said that misinformation or, you know, lying about, you know, false information as determined by me about matters of public health or coronavirus are criminally prosecutable at my discretion?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, even in Poland, they haven't said that. I mean, and again, in Poland, they don't have full control. So it's a different situation. But you know, so I think he has taken some steps that it will be remembered as a kind of break, even if it's just, you know, I don't disagree, by the way, with the description that this is partly about optics. You know, the idea of this is to be able to say to people who oppose it, you're pro-virus. Okay. The Hungarian press spokesman has already said that about me.
Are you pro-virus, Anne? let's just get it on the record. You know, I mean, if
no, no, I mean, but the point of this is because what Orban does is he creates, you know, polarization. You know, you're with the nation or you're against the nation, right? And this is an attempt to use the virus to do that. Either you're with me and you give me complete power, or you're pro-virus. And it's right that it's another game to smear the opposition and disarm foreign critics and confuse people and so on. It's all part of that. But I still think it's a really significant moment and that it will be remembered.
All right. I want to ask you about the way the broader European community, not just in the EU, both in the sort of narrow EU sense, but also in the Europe sense, is going to react to this. The EU has had, as Andras describes, a kind of enabling function with respect to Orban over a protracted period of time. As Poland has proceeded under the current government, I think there's a bunch of people in Brussels and in Germany who have, you know, come to regret the permissive attitude they've taken to Orban. But one of the things about Orban's slowness has been that he's never created a moment where the EU says, well, wait a minute, if you're, you know, we're a federation of democracies, if you're not even purporting to be a democracy anymore. What are you doing in the EU? This strikes me as the kind of moment that if the European Union is not prepared to push back, it really ceases to be an organization, an economic and federative organization of democratic European governments. And so I'm curious for your sense of how Europe is likely to respond to this or whether it's going to sort of continue to avert its gaze.
Well, so first of all, this is not the moment when anybody is very interested in Viktor Orban. You know, it's country by country and also in Brussels at the European Commission, people are very focused on both, firstly, the virus, and secondly, the economic crash that's coming, what to do about it. And, it just, you know, Orban is a kind of, it's not even a third rate problem, it's like an eighth rate problem. You know, it's just not on the top of anybody's to-do list. And I completely understand that. And that makes a lot of sense to me. So I wouldn't expect a lot of movement on this anytime soon. I do know that there has been conversation inside the sort of center-right political grouping in Europe. And there is a behind the scenes, a big argument. You know, I should say I'm privy to some of the details because my husband is in the European Parliament. So I don't want to, you know, I won't name any names, you know, but there is an argument, there is a disagreement, what should be done, and it's still under discussion. I wouldn't say that the conversation is over. You know, a lot of things that might have happened in a, you know, in a pre-virus moment, for example, Hungary being losing a lot of its EU funding, which was probably going to happen, and certainly was going to happen with Poland, might not happen now because all the funding is going to be different because it's going to be to do with, you know, pandemic and economic recovery. And so, nobody's going to be wanting to punish countries at this particular moment financially. So I would say it's not impossible that something will happen. It just isn't really right this minute the most important thing for anybody. So that will determine, I would say, for the next 6 months, I wouldn't expect some huge reaction. But there is a conversation about it. People do know about it, and it will come up eventually.
I want to be mindful of both of your time, but Andras, before I let you guys go, I just want to ask you about I think we talked about this the last time you appeared on the podcast. You're being very frank from Budapest about the Orban government, which has just announced that the spreading of misinformation about the virus and the response to it is punishable by prison. There's always this sort of disconnect in my experience between the Hungarian government's sort of democratic behavior and the actual sense of threat. And so my question is, like, what's the mood in Budapest right now about this? And why are you not more afraid to have this conversation than you appear to be?
So coming to the criminal sanctions or the threat of criminal sanctions, what we have seen so far is that the new constitutional order has had a number of options that the government never used. The whole chocolate bar has never been eaten, right? We had the new constitution, for example, enabled restrictions on abortion. It never happened. We had a hate crime legislation that potentially allowed for people to be prosecuted for defying the Hungarian nation. In theory, this could have been applied for opposition politicians. Like, whatever you say, if you're critical towards the government, that could be critical towards the nation. And, you know, you could go, you know, that hasn't been used. So this, It is a smoking gun, in a sense, or it's what they usually say, if there's a gun on stage, then it will probably be used by, you know, so it may or may not be. So far, we had one case, and that was a video put up someone who said, don't worry about restrictions, the whole virus is just a, you know, scam, and, you know, just go out and get her. And I think, you know, they started a procedure against this this guy and his daughter, by the way, who was competent to operate the computers. Anyway, so we don't know. This may be used to crack down on the media, or it may just be an empty it may just be the option. So it's very hard to predict. Coming to how I or how my colleagues feel, I have to say I feel much less comfortable than I felt half a year ago. So as I said, that democratic decline 2.0 has affected members of the academia.
And how do you square that with saying it's not a big deal, it's all optics? If you say out of simultaneously, and yet I feel more uncomfortable, doesn't that suggest that actually that it's a little bit more than optics? It's designed to intimidate people and it has that effect.
Now, I felt more uncomfortable in February. I don't feel more uncomfortable than in February. I felt more uncomfortable in February than I did in October. Although October was a big emotional, a very, very emotional moment that, you know, the system, the regime can be cracked. And I think this is also something that made Orban more, radical. But again, his regime relies on money. And money comes from the EU. Money comes from multinational companies. Money comes from the German car industry. So, of course, Orban has been open to a very close ally to Putin and China. And, you know, we were the first ones to receive a symbolic transport of masks, surgical masks, which were, you know, questionable quality. You know, so there is, of course, policy openness to Central Asia, whatever. But I think that's very unlikely that the financial incentive would be comparable to the European Union. So at this point, I would say, but again, we don't know what stage the world will be in 2 months, 3 months, 5 months. And I think that's what it's all going to depend on. But I actually now think that it's not impossible that this epidemic will bring Orban's regime to an end as well, because, you know, he will just not be able to manage the crisis with this kind of political rhetoric and institutions.
With that, we are going to leave it there. Andras, Anne, thank you both so much for joining us. I don't want to keep you from dinner further.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineers this week bringing us intercontinental connectivity with Poland and Budapest alike, Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. It is promoted by the public relations firm of you, the listener, who needs to do your part to share it on whatever Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest you use. And you need to also leave us a rating and review wherever you found us. Our music is, of course, performed by Sophia Yan, who is back in Wuhan, China, where this crisis all began. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.